Okay, we're live on another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Rachel, thank you so much for being a guest today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Rachel is the executive director of Family Promise North Shore, Boston. We recently started working with her, probably her organization, I don't know, 3 to 6 weeks ago, something like that. And you've really just been an absolute angel and just such an amazing person. You've already spread the word to other Family Promises. We've started working with National now and some of your other sister organizations across the country. Would you just tell everyone a little bit about your background and the Family Promise model to start off?
Yeah, sure. So I pretty simply right after college went into the nonprofit world, working directly with people experiencing homelessness, and spent the last 10 years or so kind of between different roles as direct service staff, case manager for people experiencing homelessness, and then working in permanent housing, placing people into housing. And so I came to Family Promise with a lot of background in that. And the affiliate that we have here in Beverly, Massachusetts is, it's been around since about 2013 is when we first took families, but it's a family shelter. So a homeless shelter for families experiencing homelessness. In Massachusetts, you know, ours is unique because we're all privately funded, and Massachusetts has state funded shelters, which is pretty unique. A lot of states don't offer that. And there's actually another Family Promise affiliate in Natick, Massachusetts. There's a bunch throughout New England. And to your question about the model, you know, I think each Family Promise affiliate is its own nonprofit, but the model is pretty awesome. And you mentioned National. So Family Promise National is kind of like the parent organization that created, you know, the brand, and the idea kind of emerged out of New Jersey. And it started as a community response to ending homelessness. So they actually partnered with local houses of worship, like churches and temples, to host families who were experiencing homelessness in the New Jersey area. And it was a nice way to kind of circumvent any sort of zoning laws that would make it really difficult to build a shelter building. So Family Promise started as this kind of community coming together to really tackle an issue that was being seen in the New Jersey, New York area. And everyone, people loved the model so much that they started borrowing it. So, you know, a couple towns over in New Jersey were like, can we run the same thing? And then it just started expanding. And so at a certain point, I don't know enough about National's history offhand to quote it exactly, but
I was going to quiz you a little bit.
Since yeah. No, don't.
Lawson had him on the podcast, who's the CEO of National.
Good. Yeah. You should definitely use his information before mine. But the model itself is that National kind of grew into this more resource hub that really just helps affiliates get started. And at this point now, there's over 200 affiliates across the country. And last I checked, it was about 43 states, which is awesome. There's affiliates all over New England and every state except Vermont. And it's pretty incredible because that model started, you know, the idea of this rotational shelter, and it just spread like wildfire and everyone started picking it up. At this point, you know, that model is shifting. A lot of affiliates have gone into actual static site shelters. So a single building where they have, you know, maybe they can shelter 5 to 17 families. And a lot of affiliates are tackling other issues. So like prevention programs, diversion programs, some affiliates started childcare programs. So at this point, the affiliates really range in what they focus on, which is good because every area is so different. Rural poverty is different than urban poverty. The housing crisis, you know, it's different here in Massachusetts than it is in Kentucky or other states that are much more rural. And so every affiliate has been able to kind of grow and, you know, develop their programs according to their needs. So that's the basic model.
And I was just going to jump in and just tell you that I have been unbelievably impressed with the structure and the execution from National and its, you know, relationship with the 200 different affiliated, you know, but independent chapters. I think, I would just give a huge shout out to Sherry, has been awesome, chief of staff at National, and Sandra as well. Hope I'm not mixing up or flipping around, but it's just a really, really well-run organization. And, you know, there's a lot of different models out there, obviously, in the philanthropic world. And I've always seen these organizations that are national but have affiliated or independent chapters, you know, sort of always struggle with like whose role, what role do they play when it comes to the execution of the mission, to the fundraising, to the collaboration. Just really seems like you all have your stuff together. I don't want to cuss here today, but and you know, one of the things I know, I think maybe you'll go into this now, which was really eye-opening to me. I had heard either from you or from Klaus that family homelessness is approximately 35% of all of the homeless population. I don't know if I'm staying sort of the statistic with the right label there, but it's huge, you know, and we see it down here in Austin where we have had tremendous inequality. I think we're maybe the number one or number two metro area in the country now for basically the gap in wealth, or, you know, whatever that term would be. Massive rise lately in the homeless population. And I just wonder, you know, what can I do? What can we do? So I want to tackle some of that here, but I'd love for you to, yeah, just talk about sort of the issue, you know, as it stands today and some of like the sort of the statistics. And then if you could also talk about some of the pieces that you're doing, I know chatting with you one-on-one around the prevention side of it, you know, I think is super awesome.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think the statistics they vary from state to state. So it would be, I can talk about Massachusetts all day long, but it doesn't necessarily apply everywhere. And Klaus would know, you know, I think that statistic is a Klaus number. I've heard him mention it. And I think because he is, you know, basically overseeing all of these affiliates, or at least, you know, that's the point of National, is to support all of these affiliates. He's thinking in a much more national context, but every affiliate, you know, if I had to worry about what other states were doing for homeless services, I would be overwhelmed. So I focus on my little area of Massachusetts. And that's the kind of the beauty of Family Promise, is that these affiliates are really tackling it in their own neighborhoods, because who knows how to solve the problems better than someone who lives there. But I'm happy to kind of go into some of the data that I have related to Massachusetts homelessness. Do you want me to just kind of give you like an overview?
Yeah, whatever comes top of mind. And then I think the perspective, I mean, talking with just, you know, people, like individuals that aren't running organizations, I think that everyone's trying to figure out what can they do. I mean, I feel such, like, you know, a lot of times just despair and like wonder and worry when I see people just, you know, on the side of the road or in tents. I'm wondering like, what can I do? So would love for you to talk about, you know, what you guys are doing on the prevention side as well.
Sure. So I want to pull up just some numbers so I don't quote anything. But, you know, talking from Massachusetts perspective, I do want to state that like Massachusetts is not unique, right? So the numbers I share with you are going to be similar, but we're actually most similar to areas like New York City, LA, some of the more really like dense homeless, or I guess not dense homelessness necessarily, but housing wise, it's a crisis. Like that's kind of our biggest reason for homelessness in Massachusetts, is there's no housing. And that is not unique to Massachusetts. There are a lot of states that struggle with this, but in, you know, other parts of the country, it might not be an issue of a lack of housing. It might be an issue of very, you know, not enough, maybe the housing that is available is not near stores or, you know, other things like that. So the issues are different across the country, but for Massachusetts, to kind of get an idea of what you can do to help, you really have to understand what the root causes of all of this are. And in our state, it's really just comes down to a shortage of housing. So we don't have enough affordable units for the number of people who need them. And the reason we need so many affordable units is because our housing prices are so high and our wages are so low, right? So I know nationally we've been talking about raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. In Massachusetts, we've actually voted that in already, but it's been taking years to get there. So we just in January increased to like $13.50 or something like that. And, you know, so we're ahead of a lot of other states. There are some states that are still in like the $8 range. And, but in Massachusetts, you know, we're doing well, I guess, in that sense. But then when you look at our housing no minimum wage job can afford housing in Massachusetts. And so some of the numbers that I like to kind of tell people about are the fact that in Massachusetts, for example, the living wage, the last I was able to find, this is either the end of 2020, it might have shifted a little bit, but the state housing wage is actually $35.52 an hour. And that means that that's what has been determined as the wage that matches what our housing costs, right? So and the expectation is that nobody should ever have to pay more than 30% of their income towards their rent. And if they do pay more than 30% of their income, they are considered rent burdened. And then if they pay more than 50%, they're considered severely rent burdened. And this is important because that's how we as homeless service providers start to gauge how close someone is to homelessness, right? Or how close they are to losing their housing. And the reality is if people are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent, they fall into a category of risk because any disaster, you know, they're probably not able to save a lot of money because they're, you know, 30% of your income is going towards housing, but you're also paying for transportation, childcare, all of these other food, you know, heat, utilities, all of these things. And so if all of your finances are kind of bundled up and you're not able to save, you know, say you have a house fire or say, you know, something breaks down and you need to like fix your car and now you can't make rent. So anything over 30% of your income puts you at risk. And, you know, I think it's really, for me, like the fact that, you know, a minimum wage job, if someone was working full-time minimum wage, they would have to technically work over 111 hours a week just to afford rent. And if you're a parent, right, like this is for everyone, but if you're a parent, imagine like you can't do that. You have kids to take care of and 111 hours a week is impossible for anyone. That's kind of like the big issue that we have here in Massachusetts. And then the other piece of this is that in Massachusetts, for every person and family or household that needs an affordable unit that falls into a bracket that's like their income will never afford market rate rent and they need an affordable unit, they need a subsidy, not because like, you know, of any bad things, like they literally just would need a subsidy or they'd qualify. We have a shortage of over 150,000 units. And I was actually speaking to someone the other day from a housing authority who gave me, it was a crazy statistic. I'll have to see if I can find it. But basically, like she was overwhelmed because she said, you know, we have people applying, like it was a tiny percentage of people that were actually going to be able to be placed in the units that they have available, as opposed to the people who need it. And so the issue in Massachusetts is really just like the cost of living and the cost of housing and the lack of housing. And the other piece of this too is it doesn't have to be affordable housing that's built. It could just be housing. And if you build more housing, everything else becomes affordable. But so many people are kind of focused on, you know, the real estate market and like your property value going up. So the incentive to build a lot of housing actually doesn't really exist for people who are in the middle to upper income bracket, because why would they want their property value to go down? And the reality is if all these towns just built more housing, it would naturally make things more affordable. But that's just not happening. And so you ask like, what can you do? And the one thing I tell so many people, because I think a lot of people focus on the direct service, right? Like, how can I help? Do you need me to come bring food? Do you need me to bring, you know, paint your shed and that sort of stuff? And it's like, you know, we use volunteers for that. And those are things we're doing. And the families in our shelter need attention. Families that are actively experiencing homelessness need attention, but what I want is for them to not need shelter in the first place, right? And so the most important thing people can do, in my opinion, is educate themselves and learn how their cities are, you know, what are the zoning laws in your town? What's preventing new housing to be built, right? What is it, you know, in my town, there's laws that prevent high rises above like four stories. There's laws that prevent any new development near the train stations. Why? Like, that's kind of ridiculous. Like, why can't we just throw a high rise right next to the commuter rail? Because the reality is they don't want more people here. And then no one's going to say that, but that's kind of what happens when you build more housing, property values go down. Towns maybe, you know, are struggling because there's not as much money coming in and taxes and all of that. And so it's all very political. And
yeah, let me, jump in. I'm sort of not understanding that piece. So, you know, I'm in Austin, Texas, which clearly is an outlier in many areas, right? It's been boom town. I moved down here in February of 2010. So we were coming out of, not really, we were still in the Great Recession everywhere else, right? And I'm like, I mean, I moved from Baltimore and I was fresh out of college, couldn't get a job in Baltimore at all. Like no one was hiring, everyone was scared. Moved to Austin, and it was, ever since I've been here, there's been cranes in the sky and skyscrapers going up, office buildings, multifamily units, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I see this growth and development. So why wouldn't they want, I mean, isn't development happening across the board in these?
Yeah. So, cities? Well, so one thing to keep in mind, I'm talking about the suburbs, right? So, okay. And that's the biggest issue, you know, yes, the cities are kind of forced to build housing because mm-hmm. right now, most people who are lower income are living in the cities because those are the only places where like affordable housing, large affordable housing complexes exist. So the projects or think places mm-hmm. like that where, but then when you try to build the projects in an affluent white suburban community, that's when all hell breaks loose. And, you know, you see signs, yard signs calling the development. Like there's in Western Mass, there's some towns. Wayland is where my brother lives, and it's a very affluent white community. And you'll drive through Wayland and there's these signs calling a building called, they're naming it like the Monster. And when you Google it, it's actually like the proposal for affordable housing in Wayland, right? And it's been rebranded by the people who live there as like this terrible thing that's going to cause the fabric of their community to change, right? I mean, very explicitly, that is probably racist, right? Like there's a lot of, when people say those types of terms, like we don't want to change the fabric of our community. What the heck does that mean? You know? And it means they don't want to bring in people who maybe need to live in apartments before a housing, you know, they can purchase a home, right? Sure. So a lot of our towns in this area aren't building those things. You know, Boston has a lot of those things. So similar to Austin, but I bet if you were to think of a suburb in your area.
Totally. Westlake. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And
you know, it's like, which is like the richest white, you know, suburb of Austin.
Right. So try to build skyscraper there. Yeah. Not even a skyscraper. Try to just build like nice little townhouses or something for affordable. They're not going to let you. And that's pretty much the biggest issue. And that comes down to the cities.
Right.
And that's important to kind of keep in mind is like the zoning laws that are created, that the town, you know, the town elects the city officials. The city officials are kind of beholden to their constituents. Mm-hmm. And so if the city officials approve like this building that most of the people in the town don't want, and they can be pretty silent about it, right? They don't necessarily need to be outspoken. They can just vote. And their vote dictates a lot. And that's what's preventing more housing from being built in the suburbs.
It's so interesting you say that too, because I'll give them a plug for our Austin visitors. I just supported a new organization that my friend and attorney and proud Austinite is a part of and created. It's called Austinites for Progressive Reform. And it's the advocacy side. So there's different things that are up for ballot in the election that's coming up that I think is on May 1st.
Yep.
And it's all about tackling it from the legislative side. And we in Austin, I imagine as many cities, we have such low turnout for these. And it's like off ballot or off year. It's not a mayoral election. So these ones get even less of a turnout. So it's all about tackling these things in Austin that you're talking about and really trying to just get the word out. So I'm going to be canvassing and just kind of going door to door and stuff, because it's interesting. Like we're talking about this. I think that a lot of people, I appreciate we were talking about it from the like advocacy, legislative, like city council, you know, that sort of route, because I think a lot of these people out there, high percent of the population would believe what you and I believe and the things that we're talking about, the things that, you know, you have your expertise and you focus on, but they just don't realize that there's ways to, you know, affect change through the democratic process, you know, on a local level. I want to
hear on a local level, right? And yeah, that's part of the thing that frustrates me is you have so much more influence in a town that you live in that you're paying property taxes in than you would at in a national election or things like that. And what happens nationally really doesn't extend to the different states. And so the turnout for our local elections are just awful. Like nobody does. And the people right. who do turn out are probably the ones that are like really passionate about, you know, things not coming into their towns, and they've lived there for X amount of years. And so if more people, especially new, you know, new homeowners or people that have moved to a community that feel passionate about this stuff, start canvassing and start actually researching who you're, how long have your city councilors been sitting on the city council? Who's opposed them? You know, what have, what's their voting record? Nobody knows those, the answers to those questions, because nobody seems to realize that that's where the change actually happens when it comes to housing. Voting for your governor, voting for the president is not going to affect as much change as voting for your mayor or your city council.
And one of sort of the things that when we had chatted before that the other week that really stuck with me that I sort of want to bring about and kind of transition into is this concept of, it made me think a lot about what are all the actions and the things that I'm doing or other individuals are doing that are exacerbating the problem. So it's like, here I am giving, you know, I donated $50 to this effort, right? That's going to, you know, is like a legislative way, and I'm going to go canvas and help out and knock on doors. But then what are the other things that I'm doing to like make the problem worse? So I think about, you know, a lot of people I think would nod our heads and do this. But it's like, I mean, you would share a story, and I don't want to get too much into the specifics of it, but just this concept, it's like of people that maybe are supporting a nonprofit organization that's trying to, you know, do great stuff in their community, but then they're the ones that are opposing these laws or whatever. So it's just sort of like, it's just kind of an opportunity for people, I think about what actions they're doing, you know, whether if they're running a business, like, could they pay their employees more? You know, is probably even a simple one. Obviously, people might scoff at that, but that's part of the reality of what you're talking about. Or, you know, if you're a developer, you know, rethink things if this isn't the situation that you want.
Exactly. Yeah, I think what you're hinting at is the nonprofit industrial complex. And what that is in a nutshell is this idea that nonprofits, they fill a gap, they serve a need, and they were created to do that strategically, right? Because it's almost like offloading these responsibilities for these agencies that, like, you know, oh, those people have the heart to do it, so they're so great and we'll donate to them. But what that does is it takes the responsibility off of the wealthier class, you know, the people who are the donor class. And because they can write off things on their taxes, they can send money to a nonprofit and think, I've done my job, you know, I've donated. But like you said, they're not realizing how they're almost countering that donation sometimes by other things that they're doing in their day-to-day life. And I don't know that anyone's doing these things intentionally, but, you know, one example I have used is one of our donors is, you know, was technically involved in one of the eviction proceedings that led to one of our families entering into our shelter. And it was so removed, and there was no way that they knew that was happening. But it's kind of an interesting way to think, all right, you know, I'm now paying tens of thousands of dollars a year to shelter this family, to find them housing. It's a huge effort to find people housing once they enter the shelter system. And the best way to prevent homelessness, or to, I guess, end homelessness, is to prevent it altogether. What it fixed the systems that lead to these families not being able to afford rent, and then thus having to end up in an eviction situation, right? So this landlord, they had a right to evict this family. The family could not afford their rent. It's not the landlord's fault that they became homeless. But what I find kind of just crazy about this story is that now this family is costing our nonprofit tens of thousands of dollars to shelter, and that donor, or the donors that are, you know, supporting us, aren't donating nearly as much as we are spending to save this single family. And it would have been a lot cheaper if that family could have just stayed in the unit, or if the family could have afforded the unit in the first place, right? So like you said, higher wages. The other thing is, you know, a lot of corporate people you know, they, in their day to day, they're not giving back. So they choose nonprofits as their mode of kind of like giving back. And like you said, when you're donating, you know, a couple thousand dollars a year to a nonprofit, that doesn't change if you're not paying your employees a living wage. Like I mentioned, a living wage in Massachusetts for a single mom with two kids, it's been, there's a really awesome MIT put forward a living wage calculator that you can Google. And I'm pretty sure it's a nationwide, you can figure out what the living wage is in your town. And that's made, that was determined by like, what is childcare costs in your area? What are food and transportation and rent? So the living wage for a single mom with two kids in Essex County is over $70,000 a year. Nobody's making that. Like you have to have not only a bachelor's degree, you have to like have been really good at networking, you know, have a really great job, but odds are a single mom with two kids probably doesn't have all those things lined up, right? So a lot of the single moms with two kids, when they have good jobs, are coming to me with maybe like $48,000 or $50,000 salaries. And so that's a $20,000 gap between what they need to afford. So this is to say that like if someone, you know, is a CEO of a for-profit company and they're paying their employees non-living wages, it's part of the problem. And you don't negate that by donating to a nonprofit or, you know, get, like putting a press release out that you gave $25,000 to this nonprofit and look how great your company is for partnering with this agency. Because if you're paying your employees, you know, below a living wage, you're part of the problem. So that's putting it bluntly, but I think to me, it is really important to tackle it.
You're so spot on. I mean, with all of it, I mean, the other way that I've been thinking about it a lot is, you know, on average, Americans give 2% of their income to nonprofits. So basically, what are you doing with the other 98% of your spending power? And it almost seems insurmountable to the difference there, 98% to 2%, right? But I also think this is a wake up call also for, it's a challenge, right? Because I think it's so to speak, competitive in the one-on-one. Like if you are the owner of the business, it's sort of like, why do I need to pay more? Why isn't that other company who's my competitor paying more, et cetera? And then I think on the other side, if you're the nonprofit organization, you want to get those dollars in the door. So you're willing to do things to put out that press release or take a, you know, make a, whatever your event is and make the table sponsor 50 grand and put their, you know, put their logo and, you know, make everybody try to feel good. But I sort of just, it's really been racking my brain. I don't know what the solution is, but it's something, you know, I constantly get inspired and new ideas from the different organizations and people that we work with. And you've really like planted a seed in my mind that is really about just facing reality head on, because I think that there's a lot of, you know, high fives and glad handing in the nonprofit space, but there's not enough of tough discussions and big picture, like what do we need to do differently and kind of how can we all band together, which it's a real challenge, but it's something to really be thinking about.
Yeah. And one thing to keep in mind too, is that there's a power dynamic, right? Between nonprofits and for-profit community or for-profit companies and nonprofits and high net worth donors. So like I risk losing a donor every time I have a conversation like this, right? I could offend someone that is consistently donating and I need their money. And so there are days where I feel so conflicted because like you said, I'm like taking money to continue this service because I know it's important and I know we do great work, but I'm taking money from people who are perpetuating the problem, whether or not they realize it, whether or not it's intentional. And so what I try to do is I just try to be as honest and as educational as possible in when I'm meeting with donors. So one of the things, for example, that comes up a lot as an executive director when I'm talking to donors is the concept, two things, the concept of the deserving poor, which you can Google, and the concept of people do not want to donate to like overhead costs, right? So there's this really weird hang up that donors have when they think their money is going towards salary. And that is one of my biggest frustrations. But the thing is nonprofits are in competition with each other, right? We're all fighting for these donations. So I might be a nonprofit that's going out on a limb and telling my donors, look, you need to donate towards my staff salary. My staff is the lifeblood of my organization. That's the reason these families are getting as much as they're getting from our organization. And yes, volunteers are awesome too, but there's things that a staff person can do that they're trained in that a volunteer is not. And I think, you know, so I try to tell my donors, like, I want you to donate towards my staff because I want to be able to pay my staff a living wage. Like, I am not paying my staff a living wage, right? And I can't because I'm beholden to the donors. And so I try to continually increase it. But I know that in order for me to get to a point where I can pay my staff a living wage comparable to what people are getting in the for-profit world, I have to also explain to donors why it's important that they don't restrict their donations. So some people will give me a donation and say, I want this to go towards a very specific thing for a very specific family in your program. And it may not even be needed. Like, the family may not even need that thing, but the donor wants to feel like they donated XYZ. And then the other piece of that is the deserving poor. So donors will oftentimes like give us something and like, they'll say something, oh, I'm so glad you don't work with people who are addicts and that type of stuff. Like this idea that poverty is a choice, or this idea that homelessness is somehow a result of a decision or a bad life turn or something like that. And so those are the things we're dealing with constantly, you know, as fundraisers. I'm trying to think, okay, do I call this donor out on what they just said and tell them how awful that phrase was that they used, or do I, you know, just accept that donation? And if I don't say anything, you know, have I continued to perpetuate the problem? And if I do say something, I risk losing that donor because they can just go to another nonprofit that strokes their ego better, right? And so this nonprofit industrial complex has created almost animosity and competition between the nonprofits to fight for funding from the wealthier class that has the ability to donate and keep the cycle going, I guess. And in reality, what needs to happen is there need to be services that exist on a federal level that everyone supports and everyone can get behind that work. And the donor class, in my opinion, like, need to understand that they got to do a lot more than just donate to nonprofits. So that's my soapbox.
No, it's unbelievable. I appreciate that you're talking about all of these things. I mean, and we're going to get into some of the specifics now of what you've been able to do taking over the reins at Family Promise North Shore Boston. My only advice to you is the world we live in, especially today in 2021, the truth gets out either way, right? And I think that more and more people, when you're speaking your truth and you're just being who you are, people totally get that. And I can see that with you, and I appreciate that. I think the more that you put these things out, I think the more it's going to come back to benefit you and the organization. Yeah.
That's what I'm putting on, because we'll see.
I think it will. I mean, and look, I'm not saying to do things, you know, obviously that are detrimental to Family Promise, you know, North Shore Boston, but these are challenges that are very worthy of solving, and they don't get solved without trying to create some noise. You know, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. So, that was an old saying from one of my advisors, Martin Slachter. So shout out to him.
We like
him dearly. So I want to shift gears now, because what you've been able to tell me, what you've done at Family Promise North Shore Boston, is pretty remarkable. Can you talk about the turnaround? Like, what was happening at that organization when you stepped in, and then, you know, a handful of years later, what sort of spot are you at? And again, for those listening along, what I've been super impressed with Rachel is really this remarkable turnaround story of what she was willing to, or able to do, really by just putting herself on the line and a lot of effort, and I'm sure, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. But tell us about that story, because I think a lot of executive directors can be inspired and hopefully learn about some of the tactical things that you did to turn around the organization. So how did you find it? And then what were your decisions to do? And where are you guys today?
Sure. You know, I think when I started in 2019, they had been serving families for about 6 years. And The way I would describe it is I think it was compassion and donor fatigue, right? So sometimes nonprofits, it's really hard to keep the energy up for multiple reasons, whether the people doing the fundraising are burnt out and it's just hard to like have energy around what you're doing anymore. Because you need to have energy and excitement and you need to get donors happy and ready to give you money. And so I think when I got there, because I am very close with the former executive director, and when he chose to move on, it was just at a point when the organization, everyone was tired and the donors were tired and the staff was tired. And, you know, I had a lot of energy. And so I think that was the biggest difference is I was able to come in. I'd never been an executive director before. So I was like, I can do this. Great. And I also had a fear of failure. All of these things that really kind of came together. And, you know, for me, it was really simple stuff that really kind of started the shift. I was hearing from donors that they just wanted to hear more stories, right? So I guarantee that, you know, the first thing to go out the door for me when I'm stressed and dealing with families, like the families are my primary focus, getting them housed, you know, making sure their needs are met. And so donor related things will go out the window first, because if there's a crisis with our families, that could derail my whole week. And the first thing that I'll stop paying attention to is like sending out emails or updates and stuff like that. And so that had kind of stopped happening. And I started that up again, right? I switched our branding. You know, I think for the EDs out there, one thing to keep in mind too, appearance is a lot. I wish it wasn't, but the appearance of competency, the appearance of like, you know, we look professional, we're acting professionally is huge. And so I immediately hopped on to whatever National was recommending. They would send us emails and say, okay, everybody, here's your new branding. And they gave it to us on a silver platter. They were like, here's all your logos. We made them for you. And I went to the board and I was like, I'm going to switch our logo. And the board was like, okay, yeah, sure. Some affiliates, you know, some of their boards haven't been as, because people get attached to logos, which is so funny. And so some affiliates were like, well, we love our old logo. And my board was ready to try anything. And so one of the first things we did was switch the logo. Another decision I remember making that was just minor, but huge. We had a single phone. So anytime people called for help, if we, our staff was doing an intake, anyone else calling, we get a busy signal because it was literally a single phone line. And that made it really hard. I needed my own phone line to start building donor relationships. And so that one of the second decisions I made was to get a Comcast business phone line, right? So we had three separate lines now and we could get our voicemails to our email. So I really think that a lot of my choices, they weren't like brilliant. They were just kind of, I'm a millennial that I operate differently. I needed things to be like more streamlined. I started putting more focus on kind of like Google Drive and ways to kind of share documents among staff that weren't like paper. So it sounds really simple, but they were huge changes that really kind of shifted our focus. And then the other thing for me that was really important about our affiliate was to do a lot more to kind of stress what is called trauma-informed care. And so I really tried to shift the culture of our affiliate to focus on ways that the families, the ways that our volunteers, because volunteers can sometimes perpetuate stereotypes without realizing it, right? And when you have people of privilege working with people who are experiencing trauma, it can be a really not great situation if not done well. And so we started training our volunteers in trauma-informed care. So they were better equipped to work with our families because homelessness is a trauma, right? So a lot of our families, when they get housed again, it's months before they feel safe because they lost their housing once. Who's to say they're not going to lose it again? So really those were kind of some smaller shifts in the beginning. And then I was determined to kind of just go out and talk to all of our volunteers and supporters and get to know people. And I tried my hardest. There was a lot of other work that needed to be done programmatically. But I started to meet people and talk to them about what we are doing and how we're doing it. And people just like started to I think they were
a lot of those one-on-one.
Yeah. I would do a lot of coffee dates. You know, someone would recommend, like a board member would be like, oh, you should talk to so-and-so. And I'd be like, hey, you want to grab coffee? I like picked a lot of people's brains. Like I had a a very easy pitch, which was, I don't know what I'm doing. Will you have coffee with me? Right. So I would email people that worked in for-profit, you know, maybe their spouse was a volunteer and they like worked in an area that I could like pick their brain about. So I would sit down and be like, tell me like how to do this. Like, how do you do that? And a lot of times, like, you know, I maybe didn't necessarily need to know exactly what they were telling me, but I was building a relationship. And then I was building trust. And that was a huge thing. I think as an executive director, you need to be trusted in order for people to give you their money, because you need to be spending it wisely. They need to know that like, it's not just going nowhere. So I really spent the first year and a half, I guess the first year, building trust. And then the second year, that work kind of started to be fruitful and multiply type of thing. Because by 2020, you know, our fundraising just shot through the roof. Like, it was really incredible. I did all of our fundraisers virtually. So like sitting on my couch, on my standing desk, you know, Family Promise National is awesome because they basically give affiliates like a free fundraising platform to use. They give you all of the branding. So all I had to do was just send out some emails. We raised about $80,000 for the fundraiser in April. It was like a coronavirus relief fundraiser. And I was worried that that was it, and we were just not going to get more money as the year progressed, but people just became even more generous. And I think a lot of that was because of the pandemic, and people felt they wanted to give back. But when they were sitting there thinking, who do I give to? They had Family Promise on the mind, because, you know, we were rebuilding a lot of those relationships with donors who had otherwise, I think, just slowed down in their donations to our organization. And again, it was really just, I would really describe it as just burnout, because the staff before us was working their butts off, and they didn't have a lot of breaks. And, you know, and I'm very grateful that at this point I'm able to try to give my staff a really much better quality of life, because as we're growing, as we get more funding, that means there's less that we have to really worry about, because things that I can now put money towards, you know, I was doing on my own. So like, I might have spent hours drafting a some sort of graphic for like an event, but now I could like pay someone $200 to like create a graphic. So things like that started to shift, which is awesome. So that's it in a nutshell. Really, it was just building trust and kind of changing small things. And then now we have a really, just really well, high functioning and stable, financially stable, nonprofit.
And where, first of all, it's amazing everything that you shared. So congratulations. You should feel really good about it. I think that can you give some context? I mean, I know, you know, financials are public record, but can you give just a general sense of where you, what shape you all were in financially when you took over, and then where you are now?
Sure. So, you know, you're right. Like, it's tough to talk about, because I almost don't want to tell people where we were, because I don't want them to be like, oh my gosh. But there were a couple times in 2019 that I wasn't sure we were going to make payroll. And the funny thing was,
by the way, I just want to say that is actually where the majority of nonprofits find themselves, you know, and just like businesses are, new businesses are started every day, and businesses are closed every day. New nonprofits are started every day, and nonprofits are shut down every day. And the statistic is super high when you look at the number of organizations that have less than 2 months of cash flow to cover, you know, operations and payroll. So keep going, but yeah.
I hadn't ever run a nonprofit, so I wasn't realizing that that was the state we were in when I started. But there were two separate times throughout the year where that happened. The first was in April, and the second was at the end of the year, probably in like maybe August or September. And I'm not kidding. Like, we were $2,000 away from not making payroll. At one point, I even said to one of my board members that I didn't need to take a paycheck 1 week, because it was that anxiety provoking. And it wasn't because we didn't have money coming in. It was the timing of it, right? Like, we knew we had a fundraiser in 3 weeks, but we were living fundraiser to fundraiser. And that is very stressful. And so, and the other piece of it too, is a lot of what I did the first year wasn't direct fundraising. I was building relationships with the hope that it would pay off later. I wasn't getting immediate funding. And part of that was I wasn't ready to tell funders, especially like large grants and foundations, like, give us your money, because I knew that our programs needed work. We needed better data. We needed better like process. So I couldn't go to some of our funders and ask for that money because we didn't have the clout to really convince them to give it. And so
but I you spent- did right there, which is a complete 180 of everything that I see, is you were willing to be patient and put in the work to, you know, plant the seeds to be able to harvest later on. And I see so many, I'm sure it was, but what I've just consistently seen, and I know it, you know, bootstrapping and starting Charity Charge from nothing to where we are now, how many people that are running organizations, you know, unfortunately are in that scarcity standpoint, and they're just running around trying to like raise money, do things, but there's not a foundation behind them that they're building up. So exactly. Credit to you for taking a shot to do it the right way.
And I think that's a really good point, because I could have very easily had that mentality. And I knew that if I had to still stay alive, but if I could work on the structure simultaneously, which is why I really worked very hard that year. It was not fun. This past year was not fun either, but it was worth it. Like the pandemic really threw a monkey wrench into everything, sure. But it definitely was worth it. And so at this point now, I was able to hire staff during the pandemic. I'm currently hiring a fourth full-time employee. When I started, there were only two full-time employees. So now we're about to have our fourth full-time employee. We've launched two new programs. So we launched a prevention program and a diversion program in the last week or so. And those programs are funded too. Like we have a financial component. So they're funded by we got a $50,000 grant from Family Promise National actually for the diversion program. And then we got, we've been raising money for the prevention program. We have about $40,000 set aside for that. And that's just funding to go towards families. So we have almost $100,000 right now, just ready to go to family. So not even operation costs, which is awesome. And where we will have $100,000, we haven't received all the grant yet, but, so that to me just shows how much we've grown, because we were now able as an organization, we're able to make some really big changes structurally, like starting new programs, hiring new staff for those programs. We just moved locations. So we just got a house instead of a day center, which is awesome. So all of these big changes we would have needed it in 2019 too, but it wouldn't have been possible until after, you know, we started getting more consistent donations. And now at this point, our fundraisers are so successful consistently. And I really want to keep that momentum going. And I think I will, because we're seeing new people come into our network every day. So I think we'll just continue to grow. And I do, at a certain point, I'm going to stop growing. You know, I believe that nonprofits should recognize when they do a good thing well, not to get too ahead of themselves. So I plan to not grow beyond, you know, a small enough staff that we can still have that intimate feel. And, you know, I think the tendency is like serve more families, like get more families into shelter. But there's something about the intimacy of Family Promise, only having a smaller shelter model, most affiliates at least, that I really like. So there will be a point where I will stop growing and will focus on, you know, the baseline.
I want to add, I mean, I'm sitting here sort of reflecting as you're sharing all of this, which is awesome. I think that some of the, if value would be the right word, I would say back to you, and I think for other executive directors to take note of, you had tremendous self-awareness, right? I think of recognizing where the organization was when you took over, and then recognizing if we keep doing what was happening before, we're going to get the same result. So you were willing to change it up and then have a lot of patience while you put in that plan. And the other big thing, which is like a tactical thing that you said, but I think was critical, is it sounded like you had a great board and a good relationship with them where they were willing to trust you.
Yeah.
Which is tremendous. And I see that time and time again, organizations that do not have good boards, you know, so I'm talking, you know, in a confidential way. So obviously I'm just talking big picture here, but there are a lot of bad board members out there. I'll just say it like bluntly, right? And it's actually rare to find an organization with a great board. Yeah. So curious if you could just chat about sort of that dynamic.
I was so lucky. I think if I had walked into a different board, it would have been a different story. But my board at that point, you know, they were looking for new energy. They were looking for, they were really looking for someone like me, and they were ready to give the reins over. Cause I think, you know, the board was tired too. A lot of our board was the founding board members or people who have been around from the beginning. And they were keeping it together. Like they were holding this organization together themselves. One of our board members was basically planning all the events himself with a small committee. And so I came in and I started being like, oh, I can do that. And I took over, you know, some of those things, like doing the event, being the main planner for the event. And the board was like, oh my gosh, like, thank you. You know, they were ready to kind of have, and again, the other executive director, he had so much going on the program side that he couldn't really focus on all of those things. And so I had to kind of simultaneously take on more than I really should have, but also work to make it so the program was functioning so well that I could focus on these other things and offload some of the board's responsibility. But the board trusted me entirely. Like I would recommend something and I would explain why I wanted to do it. And they would offer, you know, like devil's advocate type stuff. But in general, they just trusted me. And my gut was really what I just went by. And I think I am by nature, I like to solve problems. So I try to kind of assess things from a problem. Like I was a philosophy major for a little while in college too. And I like looking at a situation and figuring out like, all right, what's the best path forward and how do we do it? I love puzzles. And so I saw it as like a puzzle and I'd go to the board and be like, I think we got to do this. And I'm hoping that in 6 months it'll pay off. And the board would be like, okay. And they would just approve everything I asked. But you're totally right. Like there are some affiliate directors that I've spoken to who, you know, would start with their affiliate and the board doesn't trust them from day one. You know, maybe sometimes the board can have founder syndrome too, right? So the board might not want to let go of control. So you might have some board member personalities that you're dealing with that aren't willing to give up control because they have so much attachment to the organization. They don't want, even if your decisions are great and awesome, they might counter them because they weren't their decision, right? So I was very lucky to have a board that was really open-minded and just ready for whatever I threw at them. Because you're totally right. It could have gone the opposite way.
That's awesome. And one of the things that you sprinkled in there too is your educational background, which is really diverse because we were talking about that you had also had spent time as an art major or minor.
Oh yeah.
As well. So then you have the philosophy rolled in. So it's just kind of just like a really cool background that you have that
of all trades.
Yeah. Sets you up for all of these. And when's your birthday again?
In May.
May 11th. Okay. So do we say you're an Aries or not?
I'm a Taurus.
Taurus. Okay.
I don't know much about astrology, but I've heard Tauruses are pretty stubborn.
Yeah, there's something in there. I'm an Aries and that's definitely what we are. So yeah, you've got that going for you. Talk to me as we round this out too. I mean, obviously of us just coming into to getting to know one another, why did you seek out Charity Charge? And can you talk a little bit about, you know, what financial stability or like how what we do related to your organization?
Definitely. It all relates to where we were when I started. So, you know, a lot of nonprofits in our case, especially was just a bunch of really awesome people being like, let's do something. Right. And so many of the board members that when I started too were those people. Two board members had been presidents. And then there was a third that was the current president at the time that I joined. And at least four or five of them had been around since the beginning, maybe more, and had been instrumental in getting Family Promise off the ground. And this was their organization. Like they ran it for so long. And so when it got to a point where we needed a credit card, according to the old executive director, you had to sign up, like he had to basically put his name on it. And the at the time he was like, I'm not doing that. Like I'm not gonna sign up for a credit card with my name. Like he would do it, you know, it would say Family Promise on it, but it would be his social security number and technically his liability. And so the only person willing to do it was one of our best board members, Duncan Ballantyne. He's been around since the beginning and that this man has given so much of his life to Family Promise and to keeping us afloat. And when I said I would take a pay cut, he's like, I will pay. Like, no, I'm not going to let you miss a payroll. You know, he's just always been someone to really jump in when things are needed, because he feels so strongly about making sure Family Promise succeeds. And Duncan was like, I'll get it. I'll sign up. So the card was in Duncan's name. And it was it was at a point where I, you know, I actually tried at one point, I got so sick of like, if it got rejected, I'd have to call Dunk and be like, can you tell the bank that it's da da da. So at one point I was going to add myself to the credit card. I got so just like, I was whatever, I'll put it in my name. I'm so over this. And then the application process was forever. It was like so long. And I actually, it was right before the pandemic. And so I had started it. I was about to submit it. And then I got distracted by the pandemic. And then like months later, I got a phone call from Justin from Charity Charge. And I answered it, which I never do. I don't like answer my phone these days because I just get so many calls and I never know what it's going to be about. And it could take 2 hours before I can hang up. And then it was a salesperson, right? Like Justin's like, hi, I want to speak to you about Charity Charge. And I was like, oh, damn it. And so then I don't usually hang up on people. So I let him give me a quick pitch. And the pitch was just that. Like he basically was like, we provide credit cards to nonprofits so they don't have to take on the individual people don't have to take on the liability. It's tied to your nonprofit's, you know, financials and everything. And I just sat there and I was like, oh my God, like this is exactly what I need. And I said, I was like, does this mean I can get credit cards for my staff too? Because that was the other thing is we had one credit card and I'd have to give it to my staff every time they needed to go get supplies from, you know, Target or Ocean State Job Lots. And then it would get denied for them. And it was a whole big thing. And so then I said, I can give, you know, credit cards to my staff. And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, and nobody has to take on the liability. He's like, no. And I was just, it was like a no brainer. And so then I, you know, I signed up and I was just so excited. I told my board, I was like, this is something I really want to do. I don't know much about this organization. I don't know anyone that uses them. Like I you know, no other Family Promise affiliate had used you guys. But I was willing to be the guinea pig because I needed it really desperately. And thankfully, you know, it wasn't a scam. You guys are awesome. You're real people. It's been awesome for us too. Recently I was actually just on a conversation with Lyft. So the Champs program that you're affiliated with has partnerships with like other corporations to kind of give discounts to their partners. And so one of the things I just learned today is that because Champs is connected to you, which is connected, and they're also connected to Lyft, I can qualify for a Lyft business account, which means I can have almost like a concierge, Lyft concierge. So I can actually use Lyft for my families now, and I don't have to pay the signup fees that normally go along with that, right? There's lots of little things. It's small perks, but it's perks that really just mean everything to nonprofits. And so I think the fact that you guys are a credit card company that really just focuses on nonprofits and prioritizes nonprofits, it's safer and better for me than going through a bank that, or, you know, a larger credit card company that doesn't necessarily care, right? So you guys have us in mind, and it's definitely something that I've appreciated.
Thank you for sharing that. It really just puts a big smile on my face, and it's just so awesome. We're so happy to help and really just appreciate everything that you've been doing for us to also spread the good word. It's really cool that we're now working and helping Family Promise National and a number of your other local sister chapters or affiliates. It's really cool. And I just love the organization and everything that you're doing and you as a person. For everyone that's listening, I want to let you know, if you're interested in more information or getting involved, supporting Rachel's efforts at Family Promise North Shore Boston, the URL is familypromisenSB.org, familypromisenSB.org. Is there anything else you'd like to just share with people that are interested in maybe supporting, getting involved, want to learn more?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess you don't have to donate to us. You don't have to support us. If you have an affiliate near wherever you are in the country, support them. You know, they're awesome. They're all doing great work. I know so many EDs across the country who are just as wonderful as you think that I am. And so if you have an affiliate in your own backyard, support that affiliate. And then when in doubt, support National, because they provide so much to all of us. And I honestly, like, I didn't really, I think I mentioned them briefly, but one of the biggest reasons I was so successful so quickly is because I just went to National. I was like, what do I do? How do I run an affiliate? And they had everything. They answered all my questions. They offered me so many resources. So when in doubt, support National Family Promise, because it you know, really falls to the other affiliates by default.
I second that. I've gotten to know National, and, you know, for anyone listening, they have my stamp of approval as well. Two thumbs up. for me. Really just awesome all around organization, and really appreciate everything that you shared today, Rachel. Thank you so much for being a guest here.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.